Welcome to the Party Cooperation Podcast. It is thanks to the Latin American experience that political science realized the significance of the institutionalization of political parties and of party systems. The actual forms of and logic of cooperation among parties has received so far less attention, even though party alliances play a crucial role in a number of countries of the region. Today, we will examine Nicaragua, Chile, Venezuela, and Colombia. In the case of Nicaragua, we are interested in the alliances forged by and against the Sandinistas. As far as Chile is concerned, we concentrate on the anti-Pinochet alliance and on why this alliance proved to be so durable. The Venezuelan context allows for the discussion of the practices of collusion among governmental parties in the 1960s and 1970s, but we will also talk about the recent attempts of cooperation among opposition forces. Finally, in case of Colombia, we will be able to scrutinize several currently competing party conglomerates. Today's expert is Jennifer McCoy, professor at Georgia State University, author of numerous articles and books of the region. Jennifer, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Before we dive into our four cases, let's have a look at Latin America as a whole. What are the relevant institutions that influence party cooperation?
Sure. What they share in common are, across the board, Latin American countries are presidential systems with separate legislatures, so direct presidential elections. They have, for the legislatures, they have primarily mixed electoral systems. So some seats are proportional representation within a larger district, sometimes within the whole country for smaller countries. And then some are single member districts, or as they say, uninominal. They also often use runoffs for presidential elections, not universal, but many countries do. And they have generally campaign finance rules and media regulations that help to make more equitable the competition, the party competition. And so there's public financing, there's regulation on how much advertising in media is allowed. And this varies by country, but across the board, I'd say they're relatively advanced on that kind of regulation for making equitable elections.
And if you compare this institutional setting with, let's say, proportional electoral system, parliamentary systems, single chamber systems, what would you say is the overall environment conducive to the cooperation of parties, or it's rather detrimental to it?
I think overall it is conducive, primarily with the runoff elections, because in the runoffs, of course, they must cooperate when there's only two, and they want to win. Those who didn't make it to the top two will be, their support will be sought by one of the top two winners. So that implies cooperation. It also depends. We see cooperation now, currently, because of some cases that are autocratizing, or there's democratic erosion, or there's a populist, and so there'll be an interest in cooperating among the opposition to defeat those candidates. Each particular electoral system, the rules of each one, can have an impact, though, on the ability or the incentives to cooperate.
Now, the runoff format obviously necessitates some degree of cooperation in the second round of the elections. But are these ad hoc alliances that disappear after the election, or are they durable structures that repeat at election after election?
Usually they are ad hoc for that period in government. But they may last for that period, because to get the cooperation, a party might promise ministerial positions or, you know, incentives like that. And they need the cooperation generally, because we're talking about multi-party systems for the most part, in order to pass their legislation. So a president will be seeking alliances when they are governing to be able to pass their legislation.
Let's start the survey of the four cases with Nicaragua. In the 1980s, the Sandinistas were led by Daniel Ortega. The opposition was split. Some parties boycotted the elections. Others participated in it. But then in 1990, the National Opposition Union, composed of 14 parties, surprisingly united and won the election. So what was the character of these forces that united? What pushed them towards cooperation? And what were the principal obstacles they needed to overcome in order to form an effective alliance?
They had strong incentives. At the time, Nicaragua actually had a war that was partly sponsored by the United States, the Contra War. So there was, you know, insurgency fighting, particularly in the rural areas. And the economy was in shatters with hyperinflation and shortage of goods. And again, that was due to a boycott sanctions imposed by the United States, who was ideologically very opposed to the Sandinistas. So they had a lot of policy and ideological incentives to cooperate, to defeat the government, and therefore open up aid to the United States. Now, doing this, so the opposition ranged ideologically across the board from, you know, the extreme left to the extreme right. They had a very hard time coming together, and they were helped with outside mediation, basically, primarily, again, from the United States, who was encouraging, pushing them to come together. In the end, they finally decided on a candidate, a consensus candidate, who was not a traditional or an experienced politician, because there was rivalry among all of those. They all wanted to be the candidate. They chose the widow of a martyr who had been murdered by the earlier dictatorship of Somoza, and he was a newspaper editor. So they chose the widow, who was a great symbol of freedom and peace in Nicaragua, Violeta Chamorro, to be the candidate. And with that, they were able, again, they had a lot of help, though, from organizations in the United States, from nonprofit organizations, government-sponsored organizations, on the actual cooperation part, the campaigning, and, you know, how they were going to do this. Now, once they won the election, they basically fell apart. They could not keep the cooperation going. The first government did and tried to distribute some seats, but they had to make controversial decisions. For example, the first government of Violeta Chamorro, which was basically run by her son-in-law, who was her chief of staff, decided to invite the Sandinista head of the military to be the Minister of Defense. And they had a very good strategic reason to do this in order to keep the peace with the military. But that was controversial. It was also economically, you know, it was very difficult, and they had to impose austerity. So it was hard to keep the cooperation together. By the next election, they were basically all running, all the parties running on their own or within smaller coalitions of ideologically like-minded parties.
I understand that there are at least two generalizable aspects to this story. One is the external pressure. I think we can see that in many other contexts that it makes a difference when it comes to cooperation. The other one is the need for a leader, somebody, in this case, presidential candidate, who can symbolically represent the entire alliance, then therefore must be a person who is typically not a professional politician belonging to one of the parties that formed the alliance, which also means that typically is not a politician who has the capacity and expertise to actually run parties and alliances and governments.
That's exactly right. That is the trade-off. So she was like the symbol of the mother of Nicaraguans. She wore white, you know, symbols of peace and unity, but absolutely no experience on her part. And even her son-in-law, who then, you know, was running her government, didn't really have much political experience either.
Prior to the podcast, you told me that Ortega later on entered himself into a party alliance with some of his erstwhile rivals.
Exactly. So when Ortega was defeated in that election in 1990, that was the end of the Sandinista Revolution, the beginning of competitive party politics where everyone participated. And His main desire was to come back into power. But he lost that election. He lost the subsequent election. So after that, he made a pact with his enemy that was the Conservative Liberal Party. That party was in office the second term after the revolution ended. And the leader of that party, the Conservative Party, was convicted of corruption. It was a large party. And so Ortega and the leader of that party sort of made a pact to share power and protect each other. And the hypothesis is that Ortega promised to let that guy out of prison with Ortega's influence over the Supreme Court. And Ortega later actually extended his pact making to ally with the Catholic Church and changed his policy positions to attract support from some of the conservative members of the society on social issues and following the Catholic Church, which had strongly backed also that the opposing party, the one he made the alliance with. So this, I would say, is nefarious cooperation or collusion among parties who had been rivals, each for their own personal ambitions.
I wonder what was the reaction of the voters seeing their, supported party coming together with the arch enemy.
Well, in the first election, immediately after that, the successor conservative government politician won again. So they won again, but that president had been the one who convicted the corrupt one. And so they did, the voters still supported that party, but with a new leader who promised integrity and honesty. It was the following one in 2006 where Ortega was able to come back when he had changed his strategy to appear non-radical he even changed the colors from black and red to pastel colors to look like the party of peace and love, as well as attracting, as I said, the more, making inroads into the Catholic vote. In the meantime, many of his own supporters were beginning to desert him for abandoning his principles and being so clearly self-interested. And that continued. And Ortega then continued to win subsequently. Since then, he's been in power, increasingly repressive. So not that the voters necessarily continue to support him, but that he's using repression.
In our second country, Chile, the end of the Pinochet regime brought a center-left alliance, the Concentración, to power in 1989. How could the socialists, radicals, and Christian Democrats collaborate so effectively that the alliance stayed together even until 2010?
Well, this was a really interesting alliance because the socialists, which had been the party of Allende, who was overthrown in the coup by Pinochet, sort of felt like the Christian Democrats, the moderates and the professionals in the country, the middle class of the country, tacitly supported the coup against their own leader. And yet they were able to make this alliance and cooperate. Their overriding goal was to defeat Pinochet. So they were willing to come together to accomplish that goal. So that's the first incentive. They had a major common goal, a common enemy. That's always an incentive for cooperation. The surprising thing is that this alliance lasted for 20 years. So they effectively governed together for quite a long time, basically for 20 years, alternating between the moderate Christian Democrats and the more leftist socialist candidates. So one of the ways they were able to do this, though, was to agree on an ideological principle, which was keep the market economy policies that Pinochet had put in place and not disrupt those, including the privatization of education, of Social Security, a number of things that grew to be extremely unpopular. But they did this to maintain democratic stability and maintain the peace. So even though they they were able to do that and basically govern until 2010, what happened was they were actually masking underlying polarization and grievances by not addressing the inequality that Allende had originally tried to address. And we could talk about that, what happened, you know, in the current situation, which is also very interesting.
Considering the institutional incentives, did any of the major political institutions in Chile, the electoral system, the directly elected presidential power, the existence of two chambers, the party finance regime, did any of these institutional parameters play a role in helping or hindering alliance building?
Yeah, I would say that the existence of two chambers, most of the larger countries in Latin America have two chambers. And so that's not the specific incentive. I would say in Chile, the electoral system was the more important incentive for coalitions. And it's a very unusual electoral system, the only one I know of in the world, in that it's what they call binomial districts. So it's proportional representation, but only two seats. And it's for every seat in the Congress and in the Senate, in the upper house. The problem was that the Pinochet constitution and the Pinochet, people before the government, before they left power, had seen kind of where they were because they had a referendum prior to the first election to see whether Pinochet would stay in power or not. So this group got together, the Concertación, first for the referendum to vote no on Pinochet. Then they stayed together to vote for the next president and legislature. This electoral system created an incentive for coalitions because of the two parties. It basically gave overrepresentation to the second place. For the first place, you had to win twice as much as the second place did in order to get the second seat. So to have any chance of winning more than half, to win a majority, the opposition had to make this coalition. And so they maintained this Concertación and could then get a majority in the Congress. They couldn't, though, change the Constitution because in the Senate, there were a certain number of seats that were reserved that were appointed for life before Pinochet left office. So they couldn't change the Constitution. But it definitely, that structure was an important incentive for maintaining the Concertación for so long.
In this series, we focus on electoral competition of parties. But parties can cooperate at many levels. And in some instances, this cooperation can even define the entire political regime. In 1958 in Venezuela, the principal parties, the Democratic Action, the Democratic Republican Union, and the Christian Democratic COPEI, signed the so-called Punto Fijo Pact. What was the rationale behind this pact, and what were its consequences?
They signed this because they had a great deal of political learning based on their first attempt at democracy a decade before. And at that attempt, it lasted only 3 years. It was called the triennio, three-year period. AD, the Social Democratic Party, Acción Democrática, won and was governing unilaterally. They won a large majority. They governed unilaterally. They alienated many, particularly on the right, the Catholic Church, the businesses, as well as foreign interests, including oil corporations. And eventually it resulted in the military coup that came in for the next decade. So when they tried again in 1958, they decided they would form this pact with these three parties from the center right, the center left, and agree to power share. So even though one of them, they would have elections to decide who would win, they agreed that there would be power sharing within the cabinet. So they would distribute ministerial positions. They also agreed on an economic policy to go slower incremental reform, not the radical reform that had been tried before. So it was very effective, but the consequences were they had democratic stability for almost four decades. The power sharing actually ended after the first two terms. They stopped doing that, but they maintained democratic stability, but at the cost of growing increasingly aloof from the population. And the parties were very centralized within themselves. They didn't have internal democracy. At the same time, they sort of colluded, another one of this a little bit nefarious cooperation examples, in keeping other parties out. So the two main ones, the two larger ones, ended up cooperating in this way to run. They divided up the institutions, the electoral council, the electoral authority, everything. And there's allegations they used fraud to keep other smaller parties out. They were also not open to generational change among them. And so, you know, 30 years into this cooperative period and democratic stability, it became extremely, the economy was also being hurt and people got very disillusioned. And the traditional parties really lost their support. And that's what kind of opened the door to the Hugo Chavez period.
What you call nefarious collaboration is very similar to what Peter Mayer and Richard Katz call a cartel party, where the essence is partly the collaboration and partly the toning down of competition in general for the system and keeping outsiders out as much as possible, sharing power, but at the same time providing some sort of resemblance of competition. If I understand well, this is what happened in the Venezuelan case, and that led to some sort of alienation among voters. Did the same phenomenon also make the society more polarized, more extreme? Did this configuration help radicals and non-democrats to rise and challenge the system, or was it contained?
No, that's exactly right. It did increase polarization, but it was really more the people against the establishment, in that there was general alienation from the entire political establishment, that is, these two political parties. It really became a two-party system. Sort of similar to the case of Chile today, where there's general dissatisfaction with the way democracy was going and the way the parties were running it. And again, going back to economic reasons, to inequality, a lot of social unrest. In Venezuela, in the 90s, they were also suffering from a loss of oil prices. It's an oil-based economy. And so well before Chavez came in, the two parties were losing vote share to other parties. And in fact, one of the main this is another case we see a lot, leaders defecting from their own party, particularly if they're not chosen to be the candidate. And that happened in Venezuela. So a president during the mid-90s before Chavez came in was one of these. He started his own party and he won because they didn't have runoffs back then with only 34% share, so a small plurality. This general disgust with the political establishment definitely opened the door to political outsiders. So by 1998, the election that Chavez won, all of the major candidates were political outsiders. And the ones that under duress accepted the endorsement of the traditional parties lost big, because it was a mistake to accept that endorsement.
So these are basically the dark shadows of party cooperation. Now, more recently, the Chavez-Maduro regime has been challenged by various opposition umbrella groups, including Democratic Coordination, Democratic Unity Roundtable, and some others. These alliances hesitated between boycotting the elections and participating in them, and when they decided for the latter, they used various methods for choosing their candidate, including joint primaries. What were the major organizational and ideological dilemmas of these opposition groups, and what is the chance for a united party in this context?
They had a lot of dilemmas, a lot of challenges. The first I would say is the very first time that they tried to cooperate in an actual election was after a recall referendum, when they had already cooperated to try to defeat Chavez in a presidential recall. They lost that effort, and there are many reasons why they lost, but they refused to accept the results, and they cried fraud. And that demoralized their opposition. So they were united in that effort. But the cooperation stopped at the point that they couldn't agree among themselves on what to present as an alternative. So if people voted to recall Chavez and push him out, they didn't present an alternative. Okay, what would a new government look like? Who would be a candidate? Because they couldn't agree. So they didn't present any alternative. The next election, they had already cried fraud. They'd already, their supporters were demoralized. They'd lost. Now they think it's all fraudulent. And they had to decide whether to participate or not in legislative elections the next year. So they still had this cooperative alliance. One of the members, one of the traditional parties, the Social Democratic AD, was trying to make a comeback. And they could see that a newer party that was forming, kind of a young technocratic party, center-right, was gaining in strength. And they feared, the Social Democratic Traditional Party feared they wouldn't be number one within the new legislature. So they basically engineered a call to boycott the elections. And they kind of pressured everyone else to follow them to boycott. And that was the first really large mistake, because they gave 100% control of the legislature to Chavez. And that's when he began to change all the institutions and politicize all, you know, the Supreme Court, the Electoral Authority, everyone else. So after that, 2005, for the last 15 years, the opposition has had to make these decisions every time there's an election. Will they participate or not? Because the elections were also getting more and more tainted, we'd say manipulated, so less and less fair. But they still had a chance to win. So for about 10 years, they decided to participate, and they used different methods to choose their candidates. They started out using polling, opinion polling, because they didn't really have the capacity to carry out their own primaries. So they used opinion polling to choose a presidential candidate in the first election that was coming up in 2006. And then that candidate lost, but that's how they chose their candidate. Then in subsequent presidential elections, they used primaries, internal primaries, that they were able to run themselves, and that worked pretty well, actually. So they used primaries. But then to choose the legislative seats, they didn't have the capacity to really hold primaries in all of those seats. So they used opinion polling again. And at different elections, there were different rules imposed by the government about whether they could run on a joint ticket. So on the ballot, would the joint ticket be shown, the symbol of the alliance? Would the political parties be shown? And if both were allowed, the parties had to decide, okay, do I put my candidates under the joint one or under the individual one? When they decided to put them under the individual one, they often lost overall. But they wanted to do that because they wanted to show their strength as parties. They were still trying to come back as political parties. So the rivalry among them was strong. When they could put them under the joint ticket, they were more successful. So there are a number of ways that they have tried it. Now, I will say they had some big successes. And in 2015, they kind of flipped the strategy that the Chavista governments had in really gerrymandering districts and making it more disproportionate that whatever party won the majority would get a huge supermajority. So that's how Chavez had gotten a huge supermajority in the past. Well, the opposition kind of flipped that logic and began to want to win in those. So they got a huge supermajority. Maduro didn't allow them to use that. But basically, they were able to win in 2015. It got more repressive. By the time it gets up to the most recent election last year, the opposition started to boycott after 2015 until last year. And there were negotiations to allow a little bit more fair elections, but still very unlevel playing field. But they decided to participate. But their cooperative capacity had really declined. So they cooperated enough to mostly all participate. But then they couldn't decide on a single candidate to run for many of the positions. These were for governors and mayors. In some cases, they could decide, and they did win. In the other cases, they were running against each other. And even though if you added up all the votes, they would have defeated the Maduro candidate, because they were divided, Maduro won big across the board for governors and mayors. This was just this past November.
Well, this is a fascinating story. The range of options is really bewildering. And there were many, many elements in this story that could be discussed more in depth. One point that I found interesting is this reliance on polls, because that implies first that you trust the polls, you think they give accurate information. Second, it usually make the final decision in a way predetermined by original popularity of leaders. So although this is a process that is supposed to show some dynamic of how the society is in support of one candidate or another, probably in most cases, if one of the parties has a very strong and popular candidate, that party can be sure that its candidate will be the finally chosen leader, while the others have to accept the verdict of the people, even if they have doubts about the ability of that politician to govern. So I wonder whether we can draw any lesson from this Venezuelan example. Are polls appropriate indicators of future victories? And is this process the best to choose the joint leader?
There are definitely trade-offs that I think you point out. But there's two questions. One is, do they have the capacity to carry out a primary? And there just wasn't the capacity to do that in all of these places for like mayors and or for, you know, the legislative seats in the different formats. But there's also, it also kind of depends on who can run. And so because they have a mixed system, there were some proportional representation in districts, some in, you know, more single member districts. In Venezuela, you don't have to live in the district. So the parties can basically put forward any of their leaders in any area. And so they will do that to try to win different areas. And so some, you know, they had disagreements, they had discussions. Should it be based on the strength of the party in the past, you know, their vote share in the past? Should it be based on current political polling? What about the popularity of the people? So the parties want to put their top leaders in places. Maybe they're not the most popular person, but they are, you know, the authoritative person of the party or the strong man of the party. So all of these things are coming into play in these debates. And I think, you know, there's no perfect way to do it, but particularly if you can't do a primary to really test it with the people. And in that case, and Venezuela actually has pretty good polling. They have a pretty sophisticated polling capacity of a lot of different private firms who do a pretty good job. So, you know, but they didn't always rely on that. Sometimes they were just negotiating, you know, which party should be able to have this seat versus that seat. You know, in some of the elections, they did it that way, just pure negotiation.
As far as the fourth country, Colombia, is concerned, Right now, we are at the beginning of an electoral campaign, the campaign for the May 2022 elections. The government is challenged by three potential alliances, a center-right one, a center-left one, and the leftist historical pact for Colombia. All of them are expected to hold some sort of consultation, essentially primaries, very soon, a couple of weeks from now. What are the traditions of party cooperation in Colombia? Why do we have three oppositional alliances and not one? And what are the institutional incentives in this country for a broad cooperation?
Well, Colombia had a similar experience to Venezuela in some ways, but it was a long-term, 150-year-old democracy with competitive elections, but very elitist. So they had a strong elitist two-party system for 150 years. Those two main parties, liberals and conservatives, also had a period when they had an actual party-sharing, power-sharing pact between them. That was after a decade of violence in the 1950s. So they came in, and for the next 16 years, they had a preordained agreement to alternate power. So there was no choice, really, for the people. Nobody else could run. There was, you know, little choice at the presidential level. After that, again, dissatisfaction is growing, and they did rewrite the constitution, but there's also a guerrilla insurgency. So basically, more parties, the two main parties began to split. And this is really important for cooperation, for incentives, when you think about this. The individual leaders, you know, the only chance to move forward is basically to split. And so that happened, especially in 2002, when a disgruntled candidate who wasn't chosen to be the presidential candidate split and ran as an independent and won. More and more splits started happening. So we have almost a deinstitutionalization of the party system, fragmentation. And you ended up with like 16 parties represented by the time you get to 2014 in the legislature. So you have to form a coalition to govern. I mean, it's too splintered not to. But it was somewhat easy to form coalitions because these were mostly splinters from the same ideological camps. So they shared ideological sentiments within the groups of the parties, the center left, the center right, the new kind of right that was forming from one of these splits. And then there were leftists that were forming as well. So first, coalitions are necessary to govern and to win. So that's a strong incentive because there's too many parties. And we're talking about a PR system. And second, it's facilitated because they share these ideological similarities. But I would say there's a third incentive for forming coalitions recently, and it's a more defensive incentive that they were doing so to prevent the victory of a more feared alternative. So, for example, in 2014, the candidate was running for the second term who had been leading the peace process talks with guerrillas. They had a civil war for 50 years. And the left in the runoff threw their support behind this very centrist, center-right candidate in order to save the peace process from the far right who wanted to abolish it. And then in 2018, the most recent election, it ended up in a runoff between the left and the right. The center had dropped out. And the left, you know, it was kind of seen as two extremes that people had to choose from. So for the current election that you were talking about, these multiple coalitions coming forward, the incentive for especially the centers were to avoid that result from the last one of the two extremes in the runoff and to form coalitions. So we have a center-right, a center-left, a left coalition, and then we have the right-wing party running mostly by itself over here. So the consultation, the primaries, will be in March to choose those three coalitions against, and then there'll be a right. So there'll be four kind of major candidates. There are some independent candidates too, so it's not, you know, it's still an extremely competitive election. But those are the incentives for why they're cooperating. And then the PR electoral system, is the institutional mechanism.
Yeah, so what we are talking about here in this case and in some other cases is a very complex institutional environment that on the one hand encourages political entrepreneurs to split or at least maintain the identity of their own party separately, but at the very same time to cooperate with other parties. So neither complete merger of the opposition is on the table in most of these cases, nor kind of strategy that would keep complete sovereignty, independence for each party, and would allow the parties to start to think about the coalition only after the election. So they have to think already about some form of cooperation during the electoral campaign, but it is very rarely a complete fusion.
That's exactly right. No, they're still maintaining their identities, and to different degrees and in different countries that we've talked about, you know, they're willing to sacrifice enough to really come together and just run a single candidate or not. In the Colombian case, yes, they're maintaining their own identities, but cooperating within these coalitions and then trying to govern afterwards, particularly with the trying to maintain that coalition in the legislature to be able to, you know, pass their legislation. And so they have been doing that fairly successfully over the last couple of terms, maintaining these coalitions within the legislature. It's not guaranteed, but they've been doing pretty well with that. I would say also Colombia is a little bit different in that there's not a clear enemy that everyone else is uniting against. It's not polarized around a single incumbent that is autocratizing or was a dictator like Pinochet in Chile. So you had those incentives for an initial coalition of wide range of ideologies. In Colombia, it's these smaller coalitions that are more ideologically similar, you know, competing in more of a normal election, but with polarization rising in the country, first around the peace process and now around major social protests, you know, protesting inequality and sort of against the whole political establishment. So they've got to be concerned about that, the people's, you know, general dissatisfaction.
Now, concluding the conversation, let me ask you to have an overall reflection on the Latin American experience. We are talking about parties can not only be held responsible in some instances for bad governance, but sometimes can be held responsible for undermining democracy and causing major civil conflicts, sometimes even civil wars. So the stakes in Latin American politics is sometimes considerably higher than in European other established democracies. Keeping this in mind, how shall we evaluate the behavior of political parties? How shall we consider their achievements in terms of trying to cooperate for making the tension lower? To what extent the cooperation is actually avenue for increasing clientelism and corruption. So what would be your overall evaluation of the Latin American parties' performance in this regard?
Yeah, of course, there's a wide variety within Latin America on the party systems. But overall, there have been instances of really fantastic sort of innovation and learning that we see in party cooperation, especially when they've gone through a devastating period of a military dictatorship or extreme violence, as we mentioned in the cases of Chile, Colombia, and Venezuela. And so that kind of cooperation to the degree of power sharing, actual power sharing, you know, is really important. And Nicaragua as well. So the early coming together against a very repressive situation is a great incentive, and they've done quite well. But another lesson to learn from that is that if they become cartels, if they begin to exclude others, those parties that initially shared, or one party becomes hegemonic, that and if they become more and more aloof from the people and unresponsive to the people, particularly when they begin colluding to protect their own corrupt practices, then the whole thing's going to blow up again, and the people are going to rebel, and they have. Because Latin America has been able to maintain electoral practices, really since the return of the restoration of democracy in many countries in the mid-70s, the third wave of democracy. So the people do use that right of election, and they will reject establishment parties. So establishment parties need to keep that lesson in, you know, in mind. And then I think there's also the lesson of when you are trying to cooperate, and particularly if you have like a major goal, when we're talking about now, the more current, more populist authoritarian alternatives, and we can see Bolsonaro in Brazil be another case that's coming up, the election in Brazil coming up this fall. Then when the parties, you know, if you're fighting for a principle, if you're uniting for a principle, then it's really difficult for them, but important to not let their personal ambitions and rivalries override the collective interest that they're fighting for.
Jennifer, let me thank you for coming to us and for this great overview.